This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It sounds so simple. Child's play, really. Come up with some idea for a toy that's going to sell for maybe $5.99. Outsource the manufacturing, clear millions in profit. Just don't forget to add those follow-on costs for lead paint. Today, American toy companies drew the bottom line. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us today. It's Monday, the 10th of September, which by my count gives us something like 3.5 months until Christmas. Might seem like a good long while, but if you're an American toy company, you've got your work cut out for you. Last week, Mattel, as you surely remember, recalled yet another batch of lead-tainted Chinese-made toys, the third such recall this summer for the world's biggest toy company. U.S. and Chinese regulators met in Washington today to discuss the safety of those Chinese imports. Regulators are expected to adopt new standards to prevent products containing lead paint from entering the United States. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports that as the holiday shopping season approaches, the toy industry is taking matters into its own hands.
Disney warned manufacturers today it plans to start looking over their shoulders. Disney licenses Mattel and thousands of others to make toys based on its movies and TV shows. Those manufacturers will still be responsible for product safety, but Disney will do its own random testing as well. Retailer Toys R Us and other marketers like Sesame Workshop and Nickelodeon say they're stepping up their testing. Industry analyst Chris Byrne says anyone involved with toys these days is nervous.
They can't let their brand be diluted or harmed in any way. So I think it's a level of security that they're taking to ensure themselves and their consumers. And yes, hopefully to get some public relations benefit out of it as well.
The string of recalls and bad publicity doesn't seem to have hurt toy sales so far, analysts say. But toy retailers do the bulk of their business between November and January. Jim Silver publishes Toy Wishes magazine. He says all the extra testing costs money, and by next holiday season, parents might see toy prices rising.
If you're paying $6.99 for an action figure, you might be paying $7.99 for it, to add in all these extra lines of safety measures.
Analysts say more scrutiny is bound to turn up more health hazards. Advocacy group Kids in Danger says last year manufacturers recalled 18 million individual toys and other children's products. The group says recalls so far this year total 28 million. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Officials at the Food and Drug Administration spent their day with the ever-expanding American waistline. The FDA is looking at food labels, debating how those labels might help consumers make healthy choices. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, Helen Palmer reports there are plenty of ideas, but not much consensus.
The idea is to get easily recognizable simple symbols on food to help consumers make healthy choices. There are already a bunch out there, says the FDA's Barbara Schneeman.
Manufacturers have developed symbols. There's some consumer groups that have developed symbols. We know that there health organizations like American Heart that have also developed symbols.
The heart symbol's familiar on food packaging and menus. One supermarket chain devised a star system, 25,000 food items rate between 0 and 3 stars. Schneeman says these symbols are based on different nutritional criteria, like amount of fat or fiber.
We're also asking, are there situations where it could confuse consumers or lead them to make a less than healthful food choice?
That's a problem nutritionists see with current food labeling. Tufts University's Alice Lichtenstein.
And the amount of information at the moment is quite overwhelming. And for certain foods, some of it is not necessarily helpful.
Lichtenstein says a simpler system would make nutrition information more accessible. Like the UK's food traffic light system. Foods with a green sticker, go ahead. Amber, caution. Red, stop. U.S. food companies don't want those kinds of symbols imposed. And mandatory label changes are expensive, says Robert Earle of the Grocery Manufacturers Association.
In short, it costs real money. And those costs are sometimes absorbed and sometimes are included in food costs.
Earle says food manufacturers compete to deliver healthier products. Current labels are based on the science of the government's food pyramid, and the system works well. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
General David Petraeus made his long-awaited appearance on Capitol Hill today. The general said he believes the United States can reduce its presence in Iraq to pre-surge levels by next summer, to about 130,000 troops, that is. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports American defense contractors see that as an opportunity.
According to a Pentagon report released earlier this year, there are roughly 130,000 private contractors working in Iraq for the Defense Department. James Schmidt is Senior Vice President for Armor Group North America. His company earned about half its total revenue, or $133 million, in Iraq last year. He sees the potential for more.
If the military decides to make reductions in force within Iraq, the private industry can help in that process.
Schmidt believes as U.S. commanders adjust to having fewer boots on the ground, they'll inevitably feel stretched. He hopes they'll turn to private companies like his.
We can take on roles, particularly in defensive protective security services, that might free up some of those forces to be better optimally utilized.
Most contractors in Iraq offer logistical support, delivering meals or doing laundry. Some help train the Iraqi police or army, and about 25,000 work in security. Analysts say more security jobs could open up for contractors as U.S. troops leave, and Iraqi firms are well-positioned to get that business because of connections. But...
well, the reality, it may be militia incorporated right now.
Peter Singer at the Brookings Institution says many Iraqi security companies are suspect.
More and more companies, in all likelihood, are proxies for militias. They're a way for someone in a political party to stash their guys in a militia and give them a corporate role.
And Singer says if the situation in Iraq gets too unstable, many Western security firms could pull out. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
A little down, a little up on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a time on Wall Street, not so long ago, too, when there was so much money out there, banks were practically giving it away, low-interest loans in the billions of dollars. Those days are gone now, thanks to the liquidity crunch, and banks have leverage that they can use now when lending. The first example of it came today. The private equity firm KKR has agreed to some conditions on loans it's taking out to buy the credit card processing firm First Data. Marketplace's Bob Moon is here to explain what it all means. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Kai.
So why has this deal in particular been getting so much attention from those in the investing world?
Well, you know, we've been talking for weeks now about how available credit has dried up.
Mm-hmm.
There are still deals that were launched back when it was, oh, so much easier to get a loan. Deals worth about $400 billion yet to be finalized. This is really the first test of how those takeover plans are going to move forward here, what the terms that the banks are going to be able to impose will be.
Interesting phrase, terms. It implies some restrictions, some conditions. What do we know about the strings that the banks are going to try to put on some of these loans?
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal reports today that KKR is now apparently agreeable to accepting loans that come with a very big string attached. stretched, something called performance criteria. That apparently means that if First Data doesn't maintain certain earnings levels, the banks can grab the money that's left off the table, much in the same way that a bank can put something called a covenant in your mortgage, and that lets them foreclose on your house if you're not making your payments. Well, imagine if they could take the house back even before that happened, like they got wind that you had to take a new job that didn't pay as much, that sort of thing. This is sort of like a hair trigger ejection seat for the banks. It's much easier to force a company into bankruptcy, and the power is clearly shifting back to the lenders here.
Why now, though? I mean, the liquidity crisis has been going on for 6 weeks, 2 months. What's the sense of urgency?
Well, they need to close these deals, and the banks aren't just trying to protect themselves in case the company should run into trouble. They turn around and sell pieces of these deals to other investors, and they were worried that nervous investors would be reluctant to buy into these deals without these safeguards, and this deal in particular. If that happened, the bank stood to lose a lot of money.
Now, did these banks and lending institutions used to have these kinds of safeguards?
To be sure, there were escape clauses, but they weren't as easily triggered as they now will be. There was a lot of money floating around out there. The banks, the institutions, wealthy individuals kept looking for a place to grow their money, and so they were willing to accept these really good terms. One case in point is something that Dartmouth professor Colin Bladen reminded us of. We spoke to him a while back about this, and he said these private equity deals were proving to be very lucrative investments that really held the promise of keeping retirement plans, for example, growing for millions of Americans.
Because these deals performed very well, people who were looking to invest their money, particularly pension funds, they noticed this and began to put a lot of money into these funds.
That's just part of the picture, though. You know, Kai, it does really boil down to those two emotions that we talk about ruling the stock market, fear and greed here. For a while, we had the big banks and the institutional investors greedy for bigger returns. Now they're taking a look at the risk of default. And to a degree, fear is causing them to be a lot more careful.
Very quickly, before I let you go, this is the first deal to sort of come to terms since the liquidity crisis. I imagine everybody else is watching this.
That's right. Could be dominoes right down the line.
All right. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street was playing a game of wait and see today. Investors are waiting mostly on two things. One is the Fed meeting next Tuesday. The other is earnings reports from big banks and brokerages that'll come out next week. They'll be another indicator of how badly the subprime crisis has spread. As complicated as the banking system is in this country, imagine a place now with no loans, no checks, and no credit cards, where the population is paid in cash. That was the Syrian economy just a couple of years ago. Now, though, Damascus wants to do business with the European Union. But before that can happen, the country has to modernize its financial system. Jennifer Glass reports private banks are leading the way.
You still see big piles of cash being counted by machines in Syrian banks. But little by little, things are changing. Syria is trying to modernize its banking system. ATMs have sprung up around Damascus, and you can carry dollars around openly. That's new. Syria's authoritarian government used to prohibit Syrians from dealing in foreign currency, one way to control the population.
You have $100 in your bag. 4 years ago, you were exposed to go to jail. Now we are making steps and steps and steps into an opening of the market, an opening of the economy.
George Saya runs a private bank. He left Syria 30 years ago to become a banker in neighboring Lebanon. He's returned to run a private consortium of foreign-owned banks. He says private banks are stepping in where state-run banks have refused to go.
We started personal loans. We started car loans. We started the mortgage, the housing loan, but still we need more steps to be done.
Time was, Syrians couldn't get private bank loans. Homebuyers showed up at closings with enormous sacks of money. And many Syrians, mistrustful of the state-run banks, stashed their cash at home. But Syrians are catching on to the new banking system. 4 years ago, only about 8% of the population used a bank. Now it's more like 25%. Bank customer Mohammed Ayoubi loves the efficiency of private banking.
If I had my account at the commercial bank, it would take 10 extra days to get my transfer. So here it's a lot easier.
Private banks are introducing other things they think will make life easier for customers like Ayoubi: checkbooks and credit cards. And Islamic banks for Muslims who've stayed away because their religion forbids earning interest. The goal, to get all that Syrian money out from under the mattresses and floorboards and into a bank. But revamping the Byzantine central bank is proving difficult. Entrenched middle management, accustomed to bureaucracy, is resisting change. There were plans for a new stock market to be opened by now, maybe next year.
When I asked you about...
There is some progress.
When I asked you about time flying by, you will look at the title. What does it say?
Time flies.
Like teaching employees to speak English. That will be a key skill to process international transactions. Opening up to English lessons and foreign banks signals a sea change for Syria. The economy stagnated under government control. Many here hope expanding banking reforms will spur economic growth. In Damascus, I'm Jennifer Glass for Marketplace.
Coming up, a biotech CEO muses on strategy, success, and stress.
Every company goes through its own time of trial, and it's our time right now.
It's another conversation from the corner office, but first, let's do the numbers. Investors are still worried about what the Fed might be cooking up on interest rates, and that was a recipe for pancakes on Wall Street today. Major indices closed nearly flat. Get it? Pancakes flat. The Dow struggled 14 points higher, just a tenth of 1% in a late session rally. The blue chips ended trading at 13,127. The NASDAQ edged lower 6 points, a quarter percent, to finish at 2559. The S&P 500 shaved off 1 point, a tenth of 1%, wrapped up the day at 1451. Countrywide Financial, which announced big job cuts after Friday's closing bell, fell 5.5% today. Advanced Micro Devices rolled out its newest microchip. Its shares rolled more than 2.5% higher. First Data Corporation that Bob Moon and I were talking about gained 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, also sponsoring PBS's CEO Exchange, shrm.org. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for the month of July. The Senate Budget Committee looks at options for universal health coverage. And the Consumer Product Safety Commission holds a second summit with its Chinese counterpart. They will discuss the steps that manufacturers, retailers, and importers can take to make products safer. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If the economy does indeed pitch over into a recession sometime soon, it won't be because consumers aren't doing their part. The Federal Reserve said today we charged almost 4% more on our credit cards in July than we did a month earlier. Although it should be said in our collective defense that that's actually a slower rate of increase than earlier in the year. With Wall Street still caught up in its liquidity crisis, now's probably a good time for those with squeaky clean credit records to keep them that way. But commentator Susan Lee says you'd be surprised by how much even the littlest things can hurt you.
I was sitting in the dentist's office when I spotted a magazine story about the 10 money mistakes that could cripple your savings. This seemed serious, so I took a look at the list. The usual stuff was there. Don't max out on a home equity line of credit, don't take on too much credit card debt, and don't ignore your company's 401k. But number 9 on the list was astonishing. Don't forget to pay your library fines for overdue books. Well, that seemed a little overwrought. Except, as it turns out, it's good advice. Apparently, libraries all across the country are getting really fed up with people who don't pay their fines. And increasingly, libraries are turning these miscreants over to collection agencies. Bad enough for the miscreants to have to fend off pesky calls from a collection agency. But worse, collection agencies can report them to a credit bureau. And whammo, there goes their credit ratings. Now, I'm not suggesting that you're one of those scofflaws. But if you are, the net result might be a lower credit rating. And that will translate into higher interest rates the next time you need a loan for a car or want a mortgage. Of course, a reasonable person might ask, isn't this a gross violation of the principle that the punishment should fit the crime? Many librarians don't think so, and they have a point. Taking a book out is like entering into a contract. If you default on the contract by not returning the book when it's due, you should be liable for the penalty. Librarians also point out that libraries are public institutions supported by taxpayers. They have a responsibility to chase down every last dollar owed to them. And if the purpose of punishment is deterrence, then the threat of having your credit rating trash works big time. So the next time your kid clutches the library's copy of Scruffy the Tugboat and begs you not to return it just yet, remember, she very well might have your credit rating in her hands.
Economist Susan Lee lives in New York City. Take a minute to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. Millions of people in this country take medicine every single day. When millions of them take the same medicine, that medicine is called a blockbuster. The biotechnology company Amgen's been lucky or smart enough to have two of them, Epogen and Aranesp. They're anemia drugs used by cancer and dialysis patients. Over the past 15 years or so, they've earned Amgen billions of dollars. That changed this spring when studies showed the drugs increased health risks in cancer patients in certain doses. Federal regulators, in turn, ordered new warning labels, which sent sales and Amgen's stock price plummeting. Tomorrow, an FDA advisory panel takes a closer look at the potential health effects in kidney patients. More warnings could be in the offing, which has Amgen employees nervous. The company's already announced what could wind up being 2,600 layoffs.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Amgen boss Kevin Scherer. He took a break from those restructuring plans last week to sit down at his office outside Los Angeles. It's been an interesting year, I guess you could say, for Amgen.
That's one way to call it, yeah.
How would you prefer to refer it to?
It's been a surprising, difficult, challenging time that you know that trees can't grow to the sky. You know that every company goes through its own time of trial. And it's our time right now. So in a philosophical sense, you can accept that these things happen. But emotionally, it's wrenching.
Two things have happened that have made the last year an interesting, difficult one for you. The first is the relabeling by the FDA. Why did the FDA do this?
The FDA got some data over the years that said that our medicines, when used above the indicated dose and in some uses, was not safe. That is, it had a negative effect on patient survival, and they wanted doctors to use the medicine specifically at the doses and in the areas that it was approved for. And it's not unusual that medicines, if you use them in areas in which they haven't been tested, or you use them at levels that haven't been tested, can have side effects that aren't good.
The other thing that's happened to you that's sort of made this a curious year for you is the decision by the government to reduce its reimbursement rate for doctors in Medicare. Explain that to us, why it happened and what that's going to mean for you.
This was an arbitrary decision by Medicare to reduce payment. It's not based on science. It's not good for patients. And we are deeply disappointed in the government's decision and are doing everything we can to change that decision. In fact, the Senate passed a resolution unanimously asking the government to reconsider this decision.
And yet what happens is that because doctors will be receiving lower reimbursement, possibly if this decision becomes final, less of your product gets sold, and so you take a hit.
Yes, that's a fact. That's not our fundamental motivation. I know it's easy to think that a business only cares about dollars and cents, and obviously we have to care about it. We care about patients, and this is going to hurt patients.
Surely you appreciate, though, that when somebody running a multi-billion dollar company as this one or any other pharmaceutical company out there or biotechnology company says repeatedly it's in the patient's best interests, it sounds a little facile in terms of business opportunity.
Yeah, I think that what you have to do is you got to do your own work to decide, do others believe that? In our case, many other independent people have said the same thing. We're one voice among many, many, many. And I think that that's how you ought to test when business people say it's in the patient's interest. Obviously, it's got financial consequence for us, but we can handle whatever financially happens. I'm deeply concerned about patients. I've had family members who've taken this medicine under difficult circumstances. Many people here know people who've taken the medicine and had cancer. This is serious stuff.
How much of what's happening in this company these days is because you have so much of your revenue dependent on these two medicines, Epogen and Aranesp?
Well, mathematically, from just a straight financial point of view, clearly when medicines that account for a large portion of our revenues are affected, that's going to have an inordinate effect on our financial situation and our stock price, et cetera, et cetera. But I'd like to emphasize that we've got resources to develop medicines, resources to manufacture medicines. We'll be okay financially. But yeah, one of the things about Amgen that is true is that we have a relatively few products that account for a lot of our revenue. That's not completely unusual. There are other companies and other industries in that situation too.
In a lot of ways, running a biotech company is sort of a gamble. Does that appeal to you in a personal sense, the element of risk and reward that's in here?
What really appeals to me is what we do counts. And our medicines really matter to the people who take them. The fact on a business side that it's high stakes and complicated and played out on a world scale, that's appealing to the leader in me, but to the humanity in me, what really appeals to me is we really help people.
Kevin Scherer is the chairman and CEO of Amgen. Mr. Scherer, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
There's more of my talk with Kevin Scherer and conversations from other corner offices on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. And by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, back in March, when financial times in the mortgage business were quite different, an unlikely company decided to get into the game, IBM. One official explained computer guys would help automate the complex mortgage process. Things haven't gone quite that smoothly in home lending, as you might know, so you might think the tech giant would be getting out while the getting's good. Not so. In fact, IBM announced today it's gotten federal approval to handle mortgages insured by the government. Investors liked it well enough. Shares up 0.25% today. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 14 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ off 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 off 1 point. That's 0.1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, real businesses with fake offices, fake addresses, and even fake assistants.
The girls are very professional, and what they've done is become very good actresses.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.